Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is part 2 of episode 25, where we were super happy to be joined by Sarah Kaplan to discuss another Journal of Management Studies classic. To find out more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you haven't listened to part 1 yet, please go and do so now, as this is a continuation of that discussion where we pick up where we left there, which is at talking about categories. Now back to the conversation.
So let me start first by saying that there are, as I say in the article, many, many, many different terms that connect to the ideas of cognition and interpretation, and one of them is the word category. Mm-hmm. And when I wrote the piece in 2010, you know, that field of research on categories was really just emerging. I mean, there were starting to be a lot of really exciting papers. Now there are even more. And if you look back at the Scottish Knitwear paper, I think it very much is connected to this idea of categories, because it was exactly how these competitors were categorizing themselves and putting themselves in one category, which was Scottish knitwear, and not in another category, which might have been, you know, fine knitwear that would have included, as you mentioned earlier, the Italian, manufacturers or things like that. So, this field of research on categories has emerged and is said, you know, has done some of the things that you talked about, which is point out that sometimes it's really good to have clear categories, because clear categories, I mean, this is the categorical imperative that comes from Ezra Zuckerman's work. It says if you have a clear category, you do better than if you're in a fuzzy category, because you trade at a discount because people don't know how to categorize you and compare you. Now, there's been more recent work, and including by Elizabeth Ponticus, who I cited in my review, that have said, well, in some circumstances, it might actually be better to be in a fuzzy category. Depends upon whether you're a kind of a consumer audience or you're an investor. And sometimes fuzzy categories are good, because you don't, if you get categorized, then people know, you know, there's less mystery or less uncertainty around you. So we now know in the categories research that there's just so much sophistication around understanding whether and when categories affect, you know, the outcomes in certain ways. So I think there is a very clear lineage between the Scottish knitwear paper and the papers on categorization. A point that I made in my review, which maybe in retrospect I would make differently now, is that some people use all sorts of the different cognitive terms, and they pick the one that they like and they just kind of use it. And I think in some cases, people have used the term category because it's a popular term in the literature right now, when in fact they maybe mean something else. One of the papers that I cite is my paper with Mary Tripsis, where we wrote about the evolutions of technologies, and we talked about technological frames, because we said it's basically how people framed the technology and understood the technology shaped technological outcomes. And in retrospect, Mary had said to me at one point, I wish we'd called it categories, because that's where the energy in the literature is around the idea of categories, not around the idea of technological frames. But I actually think technological frame is the correct term if you actually look at the underlying definition. One of the problems that I have with the whole cognition literature is that people just throw around different terms without really paying attention to what do those terms actually mean, and do I have a measure that actually matches to that? And, you know, I made a lot of those mistakes myself, too, in some of my own work, where I was measuring cognition by looking at word counts and total in letters to shareholders by organizations to be able to track, you know, basically top management's viewpoint on different things. And I was originally calling it frames or just calling it cognition. And through the review process, I landed on the idea that actually word counts and letters to shareholders kind of can basically measure attention. They can measure emphasis on one topic over another topic, but that's about all they can measure. It can't really tell you about the cognitive frame that people, you know, the interpretive lens that organizations were using. All I can tell you is I'm paying more attention to something and less attention to something else. And so I think that it's really important to be thoughtful about which term you're using. And as you know, whether you look at the Walsh review from 1995, where I think, you know, he identified 70 different term, you know, cognitive terms that were being used. In my review, I looked at all the author supplied keywords that were cognition related in all the articles that cited Porach, and I came up with, you know, another 70, right? So, you know, do you mean judgment? Do you mean cognitive bias? Do you mean attention? Do you mean aspiration level? And sometimes people, you know, they use category when they actually mean something else. So that, I mean, so I think we just have to be careful in talking about the ways in which categories connects to this paper, and then other research that uses other cognitive constructs that aren't categories but are still, you know, still tied in a way to the or, you know, their origins are still somewhere in this Scottish Knitwear paper.
But even if we go meta, category is still some sort of a representation, isn't it?
Well,
you wouldn't agree with that.
There is just such a, you know, a lot of fighting in the categories literature about exactly what a category is, relative to a schema, relative to a label. So I don't think, I mean, it's easy enough for us to use our lay interpretation of what a category is, but I think that's the problem with a word like category, is we have a lay understanding of what it means. And then there's a technical understanding in the literature, and I think we just have to, and we have to differentiate between the lay understanding and the technical understanding of particular terms.
Yeah. Okay, let's then leave the category aside, because I'm really curious in this distinction that they made in the paper, and that seems to have vanished, I guess, with time, is that they talked about the difference between the material and the cognitive level of analysis.
Yes.
Oh. Material being the technical, and that I had a bit of a flag go up when you mentioned that you preferred technological frame as a way by which one can measure these things better. But they seem to have had a distinction between material and technical and cognitive, which
yes.
would be the mental models for decision makers. So with that in mind, looking at the interpretative process, which is the continual objective, subjective, objective transformation. They were talking about the input-output cycle, where subjective interpretations, this is on page 398, where subjective interpretations of externally situated information become themselves objectified by behavior. This is already, this seems already a place where this distinction collapses to an extent. I'm interested in why and to what extent would it be useful in a study of cognitive communities to divorce cognition from materiality or a material level. And because of that, I'm very interested to hear why you prefer the technological frame terminology with regards to these categories or schemas or cognitive frames.
Oh. No, I wasn't saying I prefer technological frame relative to categories. I was saying in my paper with Mary Tripsis, where we were talking about the evolution of technology, the term that we used, technological frame, was the most accurate term for the phenomenon we were describing.
Okay.
That's different from saying I prefer it to categories. I think in papers about categories, that's the right term. I'm just saying we have to be thoughtful in every paper, you know, what is the term that we're using, and not try to, just because it's hip to use the term category, use category if actually what we mean is something else. So that, okay. that was the point I was trying to make. But the point that you're asking about, which is this idea that, you know, of the interrelationship between the cognitive and the technical, or the cognitive and the material, which is a big point that they make in their paper, right?
Yes.
So again, I think to someone like you and probably someone like me, who's a more process oriented, you know, I'm very influenced by, you know, ideas of structuration, and that model that's laid out there is kind of a structurational model in the sense that, you know, you have an interpretation and then you enact the interpretation and then that becomes the reality, right? Like that's a very structurational kind of story. I think we have to remember this paper was written in 1989. And in 1989, the dominant point of view was the Porterian view that, you know, you just did strategic analysis at the industry level and that told you about competition. The dominant point of view was a contingency model, which basically said you match your organization to the environment, or if you take Woodward, you match your organization to the technology, right? And that it was assumed that the quote environment and the quote technology were things that were truly just objectively knowable. And so in that context, it was very important for them to draw this distinction between the cognitive and the technical, or the cognitive material, the cognitive and the technical, because they were speaking to an audience that only thought about the technical and the material and did not believe or understand that the cognitive could even be playing a part at all. Right. Now, depending upon your point of view, what, you know, depending upon your ontological stance, then you might say, well, no, that when they later described that process that you described, the, you know, iteration between the subjective and the objective, that's a very structured, that's sort of a Giddens-esque structurational kind of story in which, you know, you enact the cognitive and it becomes the reality. But they couldn't, like, it was 1989, you couldn't really talk about that to a strategy audience at that time. Like, you can barely talk about that. You can barely use that. I mean, I try subtly from time to time to talk about those ideas to a strategy audience, but it's extraordinarily difficult. So you have to kind of understand, you have to situate this paper in a point in time to understand why they were drawing the distinctions that they were drawing. You know, this is relates to a really interesting conversation I had at the Org Science Winter Conference a few years ago with Sid Winter, where we were talking about routines, and we were, you know, in the end, there ended up being this conversation in the group that was sort of critiquing the idea of routines and some of the ideas that, you know, that Nelson and Winter developed in their original work by saying that it was omitting some of the technical realities or the interaction with the technology. And he said, you know, that's really interesting that you say that, but remember when we wrote this book in 1982, everyone thought that the technology was all that mattered. And we were trying to introduce this idea that maybe it was these routines that got embedded inside, you know, standard operating procedures inside of organizations that might actually shape some of these outcomes. And it wasn't just the technology. It's a very similar, it's a different path of attack on the contingency theory than the cognition people took, but it's another. And so he's like, so it's kind of unfair to critique us for omitting the technology, because the whole point of the book and of those set of ideas was to say there might be something else other than technology going on. And I think the same, you know, so making a critique now that at the paper in 1989 didn't do certain work that we might now think is essential to understanding this dynamic is not taking the paper in the context in which it was operating at the time. Even though I think you and I would both agree that, you know, that's the what's so interesting about cognition, and they do go partway there in talking about the fact that the cognition kind of made the reality. The cognition made the oligopoly, not the oligopoly making the cognition, and that was the revolutionary point they made, but it wasn't the point that got picked up by scholars.
I guess we do see this throughout management theory when we're covering older works like André Fayol and of that era, so the very beginnings, and they also have to almost use baby steps to introduce the human element into the organization and into the process of management. But because this is a paper, I think maybe we're a bit spoiled with the selection and the complexity now, and you're right. Should look at it, not if not necessarily in the temporal context, then certainly in the disciplinary context.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I mean, that was the big aha moment for me when I went back and did the review. It was like, oh, right, this is the conversation they were in. That's cool. Now I understand why they did a lot of the things they did. And that's what, you know, when you under, you know, like you asked this question, why did they make this separation between the cognitive and the technical? You can't know that unless you know the context in which they were operating. And I think that was what was so fun about doing this review.
Yeah. For me, it was more that they made it, and then a paragraph later, they collapsed it. But then you elaborated why it was made in the first place.
Yeah.
I have a related question on some of the assumptions that are in the paper that maybe today we would take in a different way or not, which has more to do with the extent that a mental model can be said to guide action. Because I have the feeling that in a way they are saying that, you know, that of course, you know, the mental model that you have is going to influence the kind of decisions you're going to take. But at the same time, they say that much of the way they see things were not out of a rational strategy that decided to set in such a way, but was, you know, they came from historical reasons that were set for to do one thing and did another one, you know. Because I have nowadays, like someone that kind of, you know, think of so action through a practice lens, I have a problem saying that, you know, understanding comes before action. They're kind of intertwined as well. It can actually be the other way around, you know, since, as we have learned from people like, I forgot her name.
Yeah, I was going to say Wyke.
Yes. I was going to say some Lucy Sutcheman, sorry, which also discussed.
Sutcheman also, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, many times we have a rationalization post the fact that we did the action that way we did, so we can, you know, talk about it that way. So I wonder it could be also the other way around, or, you know, it's something that still stays in the cognition literature, it has evolved, because I don't know so much about this kind of, you know, stream. So I was wondering, what is your take on that?
Is it also a little bit of a question of voluntarism versus determinism, in a way?
Oh, if you want, yes, yes. I didn't take in those ways, but it was more a chicken and egg question for me, you know, does the cognition come first before the action?
Well, that's, to me, an epistemological stance, it's or even an ontological stance, I guess, that, you know, there's just different scholars out there who think differently about this problem. And you know, look at Wyke, you know, he would basically say that we can never think about the future. It's always retrospective reconstruction. We always are, you know, looking backwards. We never look forwards. We only look backwards. Even if we're looking into the future, we basically put ourselves in the future and then look backwards, right? That's that's an ontological stance, actually. And so that's one camp of people. And there's another camp of people, you know, like what you're describing, like Lucy Sutcheman and whatever, which is that our cognition is produced through our action and that our cognition is super situated, right? You know, we can do math and, you know, when we're in the grocery store looking at prices, but we can't do math when we're taking an exam. So absolutely, those are like just really different takes on the world. And then you could go to kind of the bounded rationality camp and, you know, they have a different take on exactly why people use heuristics to, you know, it's much more of a rational process, except for that you have to use heuristics because you simply can't take in all the data. So I don't think that this is a matter of we've, quote, moved on. It's a matter of what is your stance. And, you know, people look at the world in just really different ways. You know, as scholars, we have to just decide what our stance is and not mix and match. Like, if we decide the approach that you know you're describing, which is that actually, you know, cognition is super situated, then you can't write a paper that, you know, would, you know, put cognition first and show the action afterwards. That's not something where there's a right answer.
So in a way, the plurality states in the field, it's still very much, I don't want to say balkanized, but there is a lot of...
Okay. It doesn't have to be. I mean, you know, you and me were both practice scholars. And certainly a hardcore pragmatic view of practice can do away with the onto-epistemological distinctions altogether. And then it's not a question of what comes first. It's a question of where do you situate the actor.
Right.
Because the actor no action starts at a blank slate where you sort of boot the system and then you look what are the inputs and what are the outputs and which came first. Because you begin in the world already in the middle of things, as it were.
Right.
And then it just becomes an analytical exercise of separating the unit of analysis.
Right. Well, that would be one way to say, you know, and one way that I talk about this is you always have to bracket something, right? You know, I was just involved in writing a kind of rebuttal about some research into the field of strategy as practice and some claims that people were making about, you know, they were doing research on practice and a number of us felt that they weren't. And one of the arguments we made is that in the field of strategies practice, and in the, you know, if you take a practice view, you would exactly see things as all tightly intertwined and mm-hmm. and embedded in each other. But you might, for analytical purposes, bracket one effect or another simply because you can't always study everything all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so then the question becomes, if that's true, if that's how you want to think about it, not everyone does, but if that's how you want to think about it, then when you do bracket and you say, I'm going to unpack this one relationship, you have to, and I'm going to hold some other things constant in order to unpack that relationship, then you at least have to be honest about the fact that you're doing the bracketing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think in this early, like if we look at the 1980s, I think things were so emergent in the field that people were not yet required to make explicit the bracketing that they were doing. And even today, I think people don't do enough of what you've just been describing, of being very clear that, okay, I'm going to hold certain things constant in order to look at other things. But we mm-hmm. understand that this is actually in a much more complex, you know, interrelated process. But I mean, I agree with you. That's sort of my view of the world, but I don't think it's everyone's view of the world. I sit in an apartment with a whole bunch of economists, and everything that you just said would be just like blah, blah, blah to them. They would not understand the word of it, right?
Oh, God.
They literally don't have a place in their brain for, you know, mm-hmm. like a concept like, you know, the embeddedness of practice. Like, it's just not mm-hmm. there. And so you really have to know what conversation you're in, who you're trying to talk to, who you're trying to get, you know, like, if I'm doing my, one of the reasons that I'm not like 100% member of the strategy as practice field is because I try to write my work in a way that's comprehensible to people who would be considered to be like core strategy people, maybe even economists, right? And mm-hmm. so given that, I have to write in a way that is, that does bracket certain things and does emphasize certain other kinds of arguments in order to be in a certain conversation. So
yeah.
We have to just be very clear about what conversation we're trying to be in and what do we have to do to be able to be legible in that conversation.
Which I guess is something like what the paper is about, the competitive groups as cognitive communities.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is. And you can see, if you look at the history of the paper, you can see how they who they were trying to be legible to. Like, they were trying to be legible to the strategic groups literature and like the core strategy people that were emerging out of Porterian research. And so that's why they had to talk about things in the way that they did.
But not just Porrick and Thomas, but even the Scots from the paper, the heroes of the Kashmir knitwear industry.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, well, yeah, I agree. We are also at a meta level in our all in our own cognitive communities, right? How do we define what community we're in? Well, maybe someone could abstractly figure out what communities we're all in, but we might define our communities differently, right?
That's why I really like what they do here, that they do not try to go the Porter route, coming back to the traditional mm-hmm. one. They define in a negative way. So they show how these people define themselves by means of saying who they are not, rather mm-hmm. than necessarily who they are.
Right.
And this negative identification, kind of even thinking of the of Spinoza, for instance, the if you give a positive, that excludes all other possibilities. Whereas if you do a negative, then that only excludes the possibility that you've noticed
mm-hmm.
and thus leaves all the other options open. And that's why it seems more realistic that people would, especially in these industries that are covered in the paper, they would less likely say, yes, we are X and Y, and more likely define themselves against other competing communities.
No, it's easier to say what you are not than what you are.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think that's easier, but it's certainly a more flexible, more maybe intuitive approach. Because to say what you are, you need to be convinced to a strong degree about, you know, what it is that you are. But that's
also draw very clear boundaries, right? And if you're maybe not convinced that the boundaries are that clear for you, it's easier. It's better to say, "Well, I know I'm not this thing, but I'm other areas." Yeah. So another question, and just curious for the group and also Sarah as well. Was anybody a little troubled like me when they were reading? They're describing their view of the world and this idea that we're for the upper scale of the consumer, and this is the kind of market we're in. Paper's authors do note briefly, and so this part didn't trouble me. It was more of the cognitive aspect of it. The paper's authors do note they didn't seem to have any data that backed this up. It was, so I recognize there's the interpretation, enactment, and then story aspect of it. But I just thought it was interesting. Maybe probably isn't the right way to say it. That there was no kind of return to the loop and say, well, I wonder what the data shows, or I wonder how we would know this. They just seemed that was the world to them, and that was good enough. So, did other people have just interesting reactions to that, or?
Let me see if I had a similar impression, because one of the things that struck me was how the authors had basically come out of this experience saying that they felt like the industry was on borrowed time, right. And and the fact is, over time, yes, the industry started to run into trouble competitively, because the other competitors started to emerge and really did knock down sales and et cetera. So what I guess I was struck by was, all right, if I'm going to be advising one of these industries or one of these companies that are in an industry where they're in this sort of a situation, and this kind of gets to the discussion of myopic enactment, what do I advise? At what point do I recognize, or does anybody recognize, that perhaps there is a vicious cycle, a cycle of doom facing the industry, where you got to say, all right, this is a problem? Because I can see all sorts of other circumstances where a similar situation or a similar presence of this kind of myopia might not be problematic if the environment is keeping this, these companies, whatever this industry is, if it's keeping them afloat. You see what I mean?
I mean, I think that's sort of like the big problem that I've constantly been working on in my research, which is exactly how you see the world blinds you to how anyone else would see the world.
Yes.
Whether it's other kinds intriguing. Of competition, yeah. Or the emergence of new technologies or whatever it is. I mean, that's coming out of my life as a consultant, and what led me to get my PhD and spend all my time thinking about this is precisely this question, that companies become blinded to certain ways of thinking, to any other way of thinking about the world, because they think about it in a certain way. They only pay attention to certain competitors, or they only think that one production process makes sense, or they only think that one technology, all the famous stories of like IBM, CEO saying, when people said, shouldn't you pay attention more to personal computers? And he said, oh, come on, we don't play with toys, because they were into big iron. Like, this is just the classic story over and over and over again. And why I'm motivated to do any of this research, and why I found this paper, but the Scottish Knitwear paper, to be so important for my research, is it kind of points to that way that organizations get blinded. And what they show in Scottish Knitwear is that this is not just even individual organizations. It ends up being this reinforcing cycle from the network that they operate in, and therefore the only data that they see. And so that, it becomes so reinforced. And they don't go that next step to the where the industry dies, but they do in their follow-up in the 2011 paper. They come back to that, and they say that the seeds of their demise was in that sort of framework that they had. So I mm-hmm. think this is one of the most interesting and perpetually problematic questions that organizations face, and that's why I spend most of my time thinking about these problems, is because that's the problem.
Yes.
And we know a lot more now about how these frames are formed and how they can change. A lot of my own research, like my framing contest paper and things like that, was about how you actually can change the mind of an organization, through these, political and interpretive processes inside organizations. But to me, that is one of the most interesting challenges that's out there. We still haven't figured it out,
Right. That's what I was curious about, because I felt very uneasy about that for the reasons you just stated. So very, very, thank you.
Well, let me follow up on that. Going back to what I believe it was Demetrius was talking about with disidentification, and I'm just wondering aloud, because I haven't studied this particular question, but it would strike me that one of the signs that the myopia would be getting unhealthy is precisely if the language of disidentification trumps identification. You see what I mean? Because if you've lost the bubble on your ability to articulate who you are, and you find it so much that much easier to say about who you are not, then it makes me wonder if you really know who you, if you're really able to enact who you are, I guess.
Wow.
You know, that. Mm. Yeah.
Do you really know who you are if all you can say is who you are not? Interesting.
Yeah. And then this kind of gets to what I do in strategic communication, because myopia is one of the things that I warn people against. I mean, if you start finding your communication campaign is becoming more and more increasingly myopic, I usually interpret that as a bad sign. Especially if you're becoming so narrow that you lose or forfeit your flexibility.
Well, I mean, I think we're pretty far away from the Scottish knitwear paper at this point. But I mean, so what I would say is that the evidence is pretty clear that if you get stuck in one way of thinking about, you know, either what your competition is or what your strategy is or how you operate or how we do around things around here, that is a recipe for being, you know, cast to the wayside in the next technological change or the next, you know, market shift or the next economic crisis. So, I think that's pretty clear. And I think the challenge, the early work did was to show that cognition mattered. Like that was part of, you know, those part of formula. You know, the next step of research, you know, they said it probably matters because they didn't have the rigorous methods, right? The next step was to kind of develop the rigorous methods, the proof of concept phase, to say, yes, we can actually really measure it, and yes, it really matters. And then the next step was to say it matters, and if we look at all the alternative explanations, we see that it matters differentially from other explanations. Like that has been the evolution of the field, is to kind of take us in that, and that's what the last 20 years kind of did, was said, not only do we have good methods for measuring now, but we know that cognition matters. And if we compare it to the other kinds of explanations that people have historically offered that have to do with competition or that have to do with the nature of the technology or, you know, have to do with resources or slack in the organization, we know that cognition matters independent of or in interaction with some of those other features. And I think the next big step is to figure out, well, how do you actually, you know, we have lots of ideas and practitioners have 8 bazillion ideas, but I think as scholars, we don't have as many ideas. How do you actually then get cognition to change when it's embedded in the ways that we talked about, when it's tied into, you know, what our P&L looks like, all those kinds of things? I think that's the question that's still up for grabs. I think that's where we are. And, you know, that's why in my framing contest paper and then later in my other paper that I did with Von Orlikowski on temporal work and strategy making, my goal was to really try to see how those frames could get changed, because that's you're right. If you get myopic, it's problematic. So then how do you change? Like, that's the big question.
I think that's a good way to wrap it up.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yes, it was great.
I think so.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Sarah, so much.
This was super fun, a really enjoyable and wide-ranging conversation.
Thank you.
We're glad. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all for episode 25. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this discussion as much as we have, and you agree that Sarah was a fantastic guest. Now, just to remind, we do have a newsletter now, so please do subscribe to that if you want to get access to the latest news as well as some other cool organization studies things. And we are now at a stage where it's much clearer what we'll do with regards to special episodes over this conference season. So, for instance, me and Ralph, we're going to be at the OLKC conference in Valladolid at the end of April. So please do come and say hi if you're there, and we'll see about putting together a special episode of some sort. Also, I'm going to be Ella as well at PROS, the Process Symposium, at the end of June. So that's very exciting, and we'll see about putting a special episode there as well. And then there's the European Group for Organization Studies, and these are the ones that we know thus far, and we'll see about what's happening with other cast members and what we might do. In any case, why I'm saying this is that if you think you'd like to get involved in some way, in any way, to kind of help facilitate the live talking about organizations, do get in touch, and it'd be great. We'll put something amazing together. Next week, we have a summary of this episode, and then we're doing episode 27 on Carl Weick's enacted sense-making classic. So that's very exciting. So tune into that here on Talking About Organizations.